You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, I am delighted to be joined by the British paranormal investigator and author, Ruth Roper Wild, to discuss several spooky cases from across this haunted isle. Ruth has now written four books, looking at cases across the length and breadth of the British Isles, and I have to say, her work is refreshingly down to earth. Ruth's diligent research reminds me of the excellent books written by both Peter Underwood and John and Anne Spencer. Ruth's investigations have put to bed many urban myths, but it has also uncovered hundreds of cases previously unknown from all over the United Kingdom. We discuss some cases that Ruth has investigated, including the mystery ghost car that led to the discovery of a skeleton, an alleged headless ghost who clearly isn't the ghost everyone thought it was, ghostly hitchhikers, an up-to-date report that she received only last month, a couple of overly haunted English villages, and Ruth's personal encounter with a menacing, shadowy figure on a lonely road. A big thank you to Ruth for joining me for this week's show. Don't forget, I need your ghost stories for the upcoming Halloween show. So if you have a spooky encounter you wish to share with me, anonymously, if you wish, please drop me a line, titling your email, Ghost Story, to mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com. I have to say, I've had some pretty interesting and creepy stories so far. So please, keep them coming. Don't forget, our Patreon is now live with bonus content, early release of the regular show, articles and monthly prizes for everyone who signs up. You can join now for $4 a month by using the link in this week's show notes. The latest episode with Stu Neville is on there now, covering a variety of Fortean and paranormal topics. Don't forget, you can now show your support with our merchandise available through our Redbubble store. The link is also in this week's show notes. We're across all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And please subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can email me at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com with any feedback, guest suggestions, or if you'd like to appear. And as always, all artwork is by Dean Bestel, and the show was produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's join Ruth Roper Wild for a paranormal tour of the British Isles. This week, we enter the world of the paranormal with the marvellous Ruth Roper Wild. An author and investigator, Ruth's books are a long overdue return to a diligent and down-to-earth form of ghostly investigation. With four books available, I've been struck with Ruth's no-nonsense approach to collating paranormal encounters. Ruth, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Oh, my pleasure. Firstly, congratulations. I know we were having a little chat off air. You've four books available, and I managed to sort of stumble across your work at the beginning of the summer. And I was absolutely delighted to finally find an author and an investigator that really reminded me of two of my favourite collectors of ghost stories, which are Peter Underwood and John Spencer. So, from what I gather, Ruth, this has been a lifelong passion that has only sort of recently developed into becoming a published author.
That's right. I started to be interested in the paranormal in my teenage years because we lived in a house that was distinctly haunted, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
It had quite active poltergeist activity, which, of course, at that age, I didn't know that. I just knew that our house did weird things.
Mm.
And I started researching into ghosts and paranormal and what have you. But we're going back quite a long time because I am a lady of a certain age. So it was before the days of the internet and what have you. So this was picking up books from the library. I was avidly sort of scouring, old books, shops and things, looking for books on ghosts.
Mm.
And I was just really interested in trying to find out what it was that we were experiencing, really, and trying to keep an open mind about it.
Mm.
And I got quite across, even then as a teenager, that I was finding a lot of the same stories regurgitated over and over in different books, and it was quite annoying because I wanted to read what's happening, what are people actually experiencing. I didn't want to hear that there'd been a black monk or a knight rattling his chains in some castle 200 years ago. I wanted to know what people like me living in a modern day house were experiencing. So I started to keep, I will at this point loosely refer to it as a database, because it was in fact a card file.
Yes.
A proper handwritten on cards card file, because my very first job when I left school was a library assistant in a technical library for Hatfield Polytechnic. And of course, we were all about the card files there.
Yes.
Because again, time before computers. So I started the card file just trying to gather data on what it might be. And it just sparked an interest. The more you read, the more you sort of found all the different theories and all the different ideas that people have had. And I started to find, you know, actual accounts of more modern ghosts, shall we say. And over the years, that interest just grew and grew as I read more and more. And then eventually, of course, computers came along and we all started to get home computers. So I transferred my card file onto a card file program on the computer before somebody pointed out to me there were such wonderful things as databases.
Yes.
And it took me quite a while then to transfer it all over onto a database. And that probably took me a couple of years to do that, because it's, my database is absolutely huge. I can't tell you how huge my database is on Paranormal. And all through that thread, I always wanted to sit down and write books about it, because I wanted to gather the stories that are real, that real people are experiencing, and get that data down and get it out there. And I just never had the time, like anybody else, you know, working 5 days a week, busy life, lots of other different hobbies. This was always just sort of something that went on in the background whenever I could spare time for it. And then 4 years ago, I took the chance to take partial early retirement. And I was in my very early 50s. And I thought, right, I'm only working 3 days a week. That means I've got 4 days a week free. What am I going to do with that time? I know I'm going to write that book I keep saying I was going to. So that's what I did. And I published the first book 6 months later. And then I've published one a year ever since. It takes me about a year to write each one I've discovered. So I'll probably do it quicker if I pull my finger out more often. But but yes. I'm now down to just 2 days a week with the real job, as it were. Now I've got 5 days a week for the ghost books, so that's good.
Well, and I think that's all benefit for ourselves as well, Ruth. It's very interesting as well, because there's clearly an evolution in how you've started, because I know obviously it's one of those things that I think a lot of people who love the paranormal or the weird, perhaps if they have a particular passion that excites them, especially Ruth, that they always dream of writing a book. And I've spoken to a couple of people recently who seem to have written the books I wish I'd written. Not in the fact that I'm jealous, but it seems that they've written a book that I've been yearning to get. And I know you yourself, you started off with quite a standard career in regards to how you launch your book, because I think your first book, The Ghosts of Marston Vale, is basically a local area book.
Yes. So because my database was so huge and I had no idea how you go about publishing books, I thought I'd better start with something manageable. So I decided to concentrate on the ones just around here. And I thought I'd give it a go of trying to find if I could interview witnesses, you know, get people's actual own stories to go alongside the myths and legends that you can find in any area, especially in the UK. You know, just every single spot of the UK has got a legend or a local myth or a local story or whatever. So I just went out on social media and put cards up in the shop windows. So anybody willing to talk to me about their ghosts, and quite quickly got quite a strange reputation around the village. There's that weird woman who keeps asking everybody about their ghosts. yeah, just started to gather that data, which, you know, here we go again, making the database even bigger. And just collated it all. It's quite a small book, Ghosts of Marston Vale, because it was literally, let's figure out how to do this. And the advice I got at the time was it was very difficult to break into, you know, having an actual publisher publish your books.
Yes.
So I decided to go down the independent publishing route. But actually, the more I thought about it, the more that suited me anyway, because I have this fear, and it's probably an ungrounded fear, but it's there nevertheless, that if I go to a publishing house, they'll want me to embellish the stories.
Yes.
To make big sales and, you know, make the books very commercially viable, as it were.
Mm.
And I don't want to embellish the stories. I want to tell them exactly as people tell them to me. Mm. And all I do is write them into prose, as it were, and sort of give them a logical sequence. Because when you interview a witness, they tend to jump backwards and forwards through time a lot. Yes. As occur to them. So all I do is order their story into the correct order, if you like, if I can, and write it into a sensible piece of prose. But I don't embellish a single word about the actual incident that happened to them or incidents. And I don't try and interpret what they're saying, and I don't try and put a certain spin on it. You know, if they think that they're seeing something angelic, or they think they're seeing something UFO rather than strictly a ghost or whatever, or they believe strongly in the difference between ghost and spirit, or that's up to them, that's their belief, and that's what I'll put in the book. So Ghost of Martin Vale was really that sort of foray into the world of how do you do this.
I mean, it is an interesting point there, and I completely understand where you're coming from, because I've had a similar kind of, I would, as you said, label it advice, but I wouldn't particularly say. And someone said to me that, oh, if you're too pragmatic, or you don't go after the woo factor, or the embellish things,
Ruth,
people don't tend to like it. And I just thought, well, I'm not really particularly interested. And if they don't like it, well, that's fine. You know, at the end of the day, I'm doing this because I want to. I'm doing this because I enjoy doing it. I look forward to speaking to people like yourself. And I would rather try, you know, obviously I speak with people about some incredible situations and subjects and things that could be quite outlandish. However, I'm not here to talk about or sex them up, as it were.
Yeah, well, that was my biggest fear, that I would be asked to sex a story up. Yeah.
And that kind of, I think, takes away from it, because with the greatest respect, and this is the same in paranormal writing, there are hundreds of versions of things like this, where primarily one of the things, I mean, obviously you've covered it in one of your books. Here in Sheffield, we have a very famous haunted location known as Stocksbridge Bypass.
Indeed you do, yes.
Which I have been to, and I have investigated myself, and I have spoken to the primary witnesses from the original encounter. I've also had their original interview sent to me by Dr. David Clark, who was working at the Sheffield Star at the time, Ruth. And they were two police officers, which obviously gives that story a lot more credence. I have to say, over the last 30 years, I have read and heard so much nonsense about Stocksbridge Bypass that sometimes it just really frustrates me, because I once heard a report that someone had said, oh yes, a lady saw a monk before she had a car crash and died. Well, how do we know she saw a monk
if she died? Yes, exactly.
And that was the beginning of this particular episode about Stocksbridge Bypass, and I just thought, well, straight away we've gone to some level here that everything after this point I can't take anything you say seriously, because if someone's driving on their own and they allegedly see a ghost that causes them to crash and die, how do we know that happened? We don't. It's clearly, it's just nonsense.
It's pure conjecture, exactly. and annoys the heck out of me. It really does when you read things like that. Because you say it's just a non sequitur, isn't it?
Yeah.
That cannot possibly be said to have happened, you know, unless she happened to be on the phone to a friend of hers at the time and said, oh, my God, I've just seen a ghost. But then actually the car crash was probably caused by her being on the phone anyway.
Yes.
It is always really frustrating when you see how stories grow their own legs over time. And it becomes like Chinese whispers, because people repeat them over and over and over, don't they?
Yeah.
And then they kind of enter the common mindset as if it was real.
Mm.
And I would rather write an entry about a particular location that says the door slammed.
Yes.
Full stop. Because that's all that happened. And everything, well, that wasn't very interesting. But it's not meant to be interesting. It's meant to be an account of what happened that they couldn't explain for whatever reason.
Mm.
I mean, some of the accounts in some of my books are incredibly sexed up, if you like, because that's what actually happened.
Yes.
You know, the people did actually experience this. And that's what they're giving me as their story.
Mm.
So I'm quite happy to take the stories at face value. I'm not there to try and work out whether people are telling me the truth or not. I don't think there's any way I could work that out. You occasionally, I will get somebody contact me with some very outlandish ideas or what have you.
Mm.
And I tend to not include those if I think there really is something odd about what they're trying to tell me.
Yes.
But mostly, you know, I'll interview a witness, and if the story is about the paranormal that will fit into one of my books rather than a subject matter that I'm not covering, then I'll put it in the book. Simple as that.
Yeah.
And then I'll go out and try and find out whether anybody else has had some sort of experience in the same location. Mm. And that's where my endless fascination comes in, is trying to find the correlations.
What struck me about your work is the second book, I believe you did, which was the Almanac, I believe.
Yeah.
Which is a fantastic idea, Ruth, and I cannot believe that nobody had published anything of that nature before, because it's a certain part of the paranormal that I've always been fascinated with, where we have ghosts that appear on a certain date for whatever reason. And I was struck when I got hold of your book, and I just thought, this is such a wonderfully simple idea that I cannot believe that no one has done it to this level before, because it's been crying out for that kind of thing. Because we often come across collections of the paranormal or ghosts, Ruth, where there are these famous stories of certain ghosts appearing on anniversaries of tragic events, or Christmas Eve always seems to be a good one, or summer solstice, or things like that. So it was wonderful to actually see a first collection of ghostly encounters that occur on certain dates brought out in such a way. I thought it was a fantastic idea.
I'm really glad you enjoyed that one, actually, because it's out of the four, it's probably my least favourite, to be honest. Strangely, one, I've always slightly regretted calling it the Almanac, British Ghosts, because I knew what I meant when I called it Almanac, but quite a lot of people have asked me what the word Almanac means. Which kind of defeats the object. So, you know, it is literally what it says it is. It's a calendar of the ghosts that haunt, supposedly, on one night of the year. Mm. And it's laid out like a calendar, so, you know, month by month. And my idea when writing it was, if you were a ghost hunter and you had this coming Saturday night free, which is, you know, October the whatever, can't work it out quick enough, you would be able to look it up in the book and see, right, on that date in October, the best place to get to try and see a ghost would be wherever.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of my theory in writing the book, was that it could be used as a sort of reference guide for other ghost hunters, other ghost investigators. The difficulty is that in writing it, what I actually pretty much discovered, I think, is that most of those stories are an awful lot of urban myth and not much meat behind them. I found a few where I had, you know, there was definite paranormal activity still going on, but mostly it's a lot of myth and legend and no current sightings. And quite a few, astonishingly, and I found this slightly annoying as well, that they get called anniversary ghosts when there's only an account of somebody ever seeing it once.
Yes.
So you can't very well say that it appears on the anniversary every year if it only did it once.
Well, I think it's one of those things, Ruth. It's like whenever anybody sees a ghost in a royal palace, it's usually Anne Boleyn. And I'm thinking, well, how do you know that's Anne Boleyn?
Exactly. And the other thing is, you get a lot of people will say very confidently, I've seen a picture of Anne Boleyn, or I saw a ghost and it was in Victorian dress. You know, or it was a Civil War soldier because it was wearing the uniform. And the difficulty with that is if you actually look into the history, there wasn't a uniform for Civil War soldiers.
Yeah.
They didn't have such a thing as uniform back then in the English Civil War. What they mostly did to identify who they were on the battlefield was they'd wear a coloured sash.
Yes.
You know, so each side would have a different coloured sash, just like a football team today. So they'd know who not to swing their sword at. They didn't go marching out in uniform. So when you say somebody saying he was wearing Civil War uniform, I start to get a bit suspicious, because I think, well, unless you're a really good historian, you know, or this person was wearing Victorian dress, well, I couldn't sit, even with all the research I do, I couldn't sit and tell you what Victorian fashion looked like for men or women or, you know, teenagers or whatever. So to me, what people are actually doing is saying it was in old-fashioned dress. It clearly wasn't modern-day dress. And it clearly wasn't so far back that we're looking at cavemen or something.
Yes.
We're looking at the civilised era of English history. But beyond that, there are several centuries where you'd have to be a proper fashion historian to be able to tell the difference as to where, you know, which period somebody came from. And then that belies the whole, well, you know, you say you've just seen Anne Boleyn. How do you know? How do you know what she even looked like? And plus, as well, if you do ever, you know, if the reader, listeners ever do choose to read Almanac, you'll notice that poor old Anne Boleyn's ghost is so flipping busy.
Yes.
There are some nights of the year where she would literally have to have some kind of time machine to flip from one location to the other and make all her appearances, poor girl.
It is. It's one of those things that's always found fascinating, is that, that certain historical characters are seen in numerous locations. Anne Boleyn is a prime example. I know we're laughing about it, but there are hundreds of them where it just seems to be a particular ghost is prescribed to a person, and that's it. Doesn't matter what it looks like, where it is, if it's got a royal connection, it's usually one of Henry VIII's wives or even Henry VIII himself. It is peculiar how these things become so ingrained in popular culture, I think, Ruth, that as you say, I think they tend to stop actually becoming historical events or actually ghostly happenings and tend to start to become an urban myth or an urban legend, that it's just so repeated that people don't see these things. They just go, oh yes, well, it's supposed to be this.
See, I think that it's partially to do with the whole sex the story up thing, because a lot of the stories to do with royalty or very well-known figures from our older history started several hundred years ago. Now, back then, they didn't have magazines the way we would think of them. They didn't have newspapers the way we would think of them. They had a lot of word of mouth. They had pamphlets were used a lot. So if you wanted to make a story really interesting and people start talking about it, you're not going to say, oh, well, you know, in the road outside this royal palace, somebody's seen the ghost of one of the cart horse men who died 2 weeks ago. Because people are kind of going to read it and then forget it because it's not interesting. But if you say that, well, that was possibly a highwayman or it was one of the actual royal family that they saw, suddenly it becomes a very sexy story and it's going to get repeated and it's going to get told. And I think there's an element of that very strongly in the way those stories grow. But when you strip that back down again, if you sort of flip that coin and look at it the other way around, I still wonder whether at the basis of all those stories was an actual paranormal occurrence. It's just that the story got sexed up, but it doesn't take away from the fact that just because you're in some ancient palace or whatever it might be, one of these really old buildings, and somebody sees the ghost of a lady swish past in a, you know, a long crinoline gown or whatever, so they say, oh, that must be Anne Boleyn, and you get that whole story. It doesn't take away from the fact that somebody still saw a ghost of a lady in a dress from a bygone era. And it's that sort of fascination for me that, well, is that still haunting? Let's forget worrying about who it is. Let's worry about whether you could go along there and set up a camera and sit and wait and do a proper investigation and actually catch some evidence of that paranormal occurrence. So even when I was writing an almanac, even though I got a bit disappointed about how few are anything but urban myth, there's still that feeling of, yeah, I think there might be something at the back of it somewhere. Unless you're in Norfolk and it's any of the Norfolk ones that were written by Charles Sampson, and in that case, forget it.
Yes. I was going to say there are a couple of authors whose reputation does, essentially, they are just complete works of fiction.
Yes. And they've entered the British psyche, as it were, as repeated ghost stories. But when you look back at them, there is literally no evidence behind them except the one author writing a story. And you think, well, to me, that suggests it might just be a fiction story that's entered the common consciousness.
Absolutely. And it is interesting. I mean, that's one of the things that struck me about your work as well, Ruth, is that if you come across these stories and you find you can't corroborate them at all, because you not only try to pin down witnesses or people that may have had an experience in a particular area, you are looking into the historical record and trying to see if you can find some actual evidence of these events. Because I know when you were on The Unexplained with Howard Hughes a few months ago, you were discussing a wonderful story about an alleged lady that had been decapitated in a certain lane.
That's right, yeah.
And this story had gone on for the best part of three centuries. However, there is absolutely no evidence that this event actually occurred, is there?
No, none whatsoever. And in actual fact, the lady that they attribute that ghost to, she's the ghost is supposed to be the ghost of one of the Lady Snags who allegedly was riding pell-mell down that lane on her horse, trying to get home, you know, sort of midnight or whatever, before her husband realised that she'd been out seeing her lover.
Mm.
And in riding down the lane at high speed, she didn't notice that some robbers had strung a rope across the lane, rode into it at full pelt, and it decapitated her as she went through it.
Mm.
They obviously robbed the body, and she was found the next morning.
Mm.
That's the legend. The trouble is that the Lady Snag that it's almost certainly going to be referring to, because she's the one that is an effigy in the local church, and she's the one that everybody round here, when they talk about Lord and Lady Snag, it's that particular lady out of the whole family over the centuries.
Mm.
She died in her 80s as a dowager.
Yes.
So she cannot possibly... Well, I say she cannot possibly, but I mean, hat off to her if she was. Galloping down a horse at midnight, having, you know, had a visit with her illicit lover at 80-odd years old.
Good for her, yes.
Good for her, yeah. But, you know, inherently very, very unlikely. And I couldn't find any record of any of the Snag ladies, you know, falling foul of murder by footpath, you know, footpad round here, anywhere.
Mm.
So, just a legend. But I did find a couple of instances where people have had something akin to the spirit of a horse galloping around there.
Yeah.
So, again, that makes me think, yeah, people sex the story up and put a lovely legend with it.
Mm.
But behind it all, is there actually a haunting of just some old farmer that was riding his horse back along that lane and died or whatever, and now his spirit haunts it, whatever. Something quite mundane in the grand scheme of things, just an ordinary person.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And like you say, attributing it to a local celebrity or someone that's well known is giving it a bit more of a wow factor and trying to do that. And as I referred to earlier on, Stocksbridge is a prime example of this, Ruth, because a lot of people claim that these sightings are of monks, but there's no evidence of any monastery in the area ever. We have no record of monks living in the area. There is no... I think the nearest abbey is 15 miles away. It's not an area that was known as an area of pilgrimage or anything like that, or anything in particular. And when the original incident occurred with the police officers, they actually described seeing someone in old-fashioned dress, and a lot of the original witnesses described seeing somebody in old-fashioned dress. Now this story is it's a lovelorn monk who was killed, but there's no evidence for any of that. So I completely see those parallels, but it's frustrating sometimes because that seems to happen quite a lot when we look at these stories. When you start to really dig into them, there seems to have been, whether it was because we had a massive fascination of ghost stories that exploded in the mid-19th century, Ruth, and at that point is that where we started to see these legends take on a different light?
I think there's been an increase of the way legends are sexed up, if you like, for sure. But I think it was happening all along, to be honest, because I think, you know, like I was mentioning earlier, if you're going to write a pamphlet and try and get it distributed in the Middle Ages, you're going to make it as sexy as possible, aren't you, to get people to read it. And I think human nature, we do it now with celebrities, don't we? We do it with the way the media writes about things. And it's kind of second nature to boast almost about any event. And when you add that into the paranormal, and you can make something even more scary by making it a monk who, you know, and he was lovelorn rather than just there's a spirit on there that was, you know, wearing old fashioned clothes. It's all about sexing it up so people will read it. But that's not, it's not interesting to me to read. If I want to read fiction, I'll go and read something from the fiction category.
Mm.
And I love reading fiction, don't get me wrong. You know, yes. I love a good story. But if I want to read about the paranormal, I want to read what people are actually experiencing. So that's where I try and pare it down. And where I'm so careful when I go out looking for witnesses, not to try and influence what I'm looking for.
Mm.
So obviously, if you mention certain locations, you know, like the Stocksbridge bypass. Hmm. So many people have heard of it, they'll know what you're looking for.
Yes.
But other places, you know, I found maybe one account and I'm trying to verify it. So I'll go out on social media and say, has anybody had an experience with the paranormal along this road or in this building or along this street or whatever? And then just see what comes back. And I won't try and tell them, because there's a legend of, you know, a weeping girl or a headless horse or whatever. I would just, has anybody had an experience with the paranormal, and just see what people come back with. And then I get really fascinated when I get correlations from that. And that to me is when you start to get into the really interesting, well, now I feel like I'm actually finding information that will help eventually somebody piece all this together. And I'm sure that person won't be me, and actually work out what is, once and for all, end of argument, what is causing the paranormal.
I mean, it is interesting as well. What I was also struck by, that often you would go to a location, or you would reach out to try and get some further information about a particular alleged haunting, Ruth, and the information you got back would end up turning the story on its head, or it would really be something completely different.
Do you know, there's so many times when I get something back that is completely different. But to me, that doesn't negate it.
No.
That just makes it more interesting. Because one of the things that my whole career was spent in investigative type work of one type or another. So I spent 15 years as a fraud investigator and then 15 years as a bullying, harassment and discrimination investigator. And one of the things you're trained very quickly on when you're doing witness interviews is that people will remember things differently, and will very quickly, their memory will be influenced by anybody saying anything to them or talking to other witnesses. They'll start to try and align their stories, not in any malicious way. It's just human nature to try and align tales and align information. So the fact that you get people in a particular location giving a different version of something they've seen, I think is really more to do with what their own personal belief system is, or what their own cultural background is, or what their own interest in reading about and listening to is. So if you've got somebody who is very interested in aliens, you know, and UFOs and so on, if they see a mysterious light travelling through a wood, they're going to think UFO. And they're going to start thinking alien landing, you know, alien contact, all that sort of thought. They're going to go into a sort of Rendlesham Forest's mindset. If that person witnessing that light travelling through the woods believes in fairies and the little folk, they're going to think they're seeing maybe the Wild Hunt or perhaps a fairy procession or something along those lines. If you've got somebody who believes in ghosts much more strongly, they're going to think they're seeing the ghost holding a lantern or something. They're going to interpret what they're looking at with their own mindset, and that doesn't negate that they're actually seeing something. It just means they're interpreting it differently. Or it could mean, there's another thing that I often sit and think about when I puzzle over these late at night. Is it a case of the paranormal presents itself however it wants to? So there's something that happens in a location and it just presents differently depending on who's looking at it. A bit like a chameleon. So yes, I send myself down all sorts of rabbit holes like that when I sit and think about the stories I get. And this is why I never try to be the one who sets limits on what the stories might be. My only parameter is I absolutely know that paranormal phenomena occurs. I've seen it, I've heard it, I've witnessed it, I've lived with it. I've interviewed so many people who have had it touch their lives in one way or another. You just can't doubt that it's out there. But the big question is, what's causing it? You know, is it the human mind does it? Is it something about the natural atmosphere does it? Stone tape theory? Is it some other kind of being? I mean, I haven't fully written it up yet, so I haven't had time to read it through thoroughly, but I've just had a long series of correspondence from a chap for the latest book that I'm researching, where he started off thinking his house was haunted by a ghost, but he's become convinced that it's actually an elemental, you know, and he's fairly certain he's worked out that he's been troubled by an elemental through all of this. So that's, you know, that's another really interesting twist on what's going on and so on. So One day, somebody will pick up a book like mine with all the data, and they'll put it together with all the other data, and they'll work it out. And I should be very glad when that person does it.
Well, it is. I think it's one of those aspects to it, Ruth, as well, because I've often been struck that we have certain locations where there are well-known alleged hauntings that some people will say, oh, you can bet your mortgage on that something strange will happen whilst you're in this location, or it will happen on, you know, within a certain period of time, whatever. And yet, the vast majority of people that visit these places don't have an experience, or they don't see anything, they don't feel anything, they don't sense anything. And yet, certain people at certain times of the year will have an experience of a variety of phenomena, Ruth. Even if you have groups of people who may be going in locations, it would only seem to affect a couple of people. I've seen numerous stories of people who have been on tours in certain areas, and people have been giving a talk, and a person out of a group of 30 has had an experience during this particular situation. And I've often found that a really interesting aspect to the paranormal, that why is it only that person? Is it something to do with the way their brain works? Is it their personality, their, you know, even things down to, is it down to their blood group, the day they were born? Do you know what I mean? It seems that certain things seem to happen to certain people in certain locations, but it just doesn't seem to happen to the majority of people.
And you can interpret that several different ways when you really start to think about it. One is exactly as you've just said, is it something about that person that meant they were somehow receptive to, or you know, were able to notice, or what have you? The other is, and I always think the easiest way to explain what I mean by this is, imagine you have a garden in any town in England. You've got a nice, halfway decent sized back garden backing onto everybody else's back gardens. And you've got a robin redbreast lives in your garden. Now, we all know from watching Countryfile and what have you, that robin redbreasts in this country are quite territorial birds. So if he lives in your garden, he's going to be in your garden almost all the time, because that's his territory. How often do you actually see that robin?
Yes, exactly.
Compared to how much time you spend in your garden. And then how many times are you out in your garden with friends, family, whatever, and you notice the robin hopping by because you're kind of used to him, or you're a bit more tuned into him, but nobody else notices him, because they're not really thinking about the fact that he's in your garden.
Yes.
Now, if it's that easy for a living, tangible creature who's in no way trying to be paranormal or anything, yes, he's just being a creature, if it's that easy for them to stay hidden in a small suburban garden, how much more easy is it for something that's paranormal to be able to stay hidden?
Yes.
And to only be noticed under certain circumstances, or by certain people, or with a certain trick of the light, or whatever. And then you start to think, actually, then it's really not that unusual that only the one person out of the group of 30 in the tour saw it.
Yeah.
Because if they were all standing in a garden and the robin popped past, it's quite possible only one would see it. Unless the tour guide turned around and said, look, everybody, there's the robin hopping past.
Yes.
You know, and then probably of the 30, 25 would go, oh, yeah. And the other five would go, where? What, Robin? And they would fly away before they saw it. And that's with a real living thing. So when you get into the paranormal, and it kind of amplifies that effect, doesn't it? And I really think there's something behind that, that it's not just about the type of people that see it, but it's something about how in tune with our surroundings we are, and whether we're expecting something. I get so many stories of people who, when they first were looking at whatever it was, they didn't realise it was anything paranormal until it did something weird, like disappear right in front of them.
Yes.
You know, up until that moment, they thought they were looking at a real person. Which means, how many times do any of us walk down a street or whatever, or drive past somebody in our cars, and because they don't catch our attention fully, we don't then notice that they actually just disappear as we drive past them or whatever? And quite honestly, if you think about that one too much, you'll get like me and scared of driving home alone at night on your own.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of my favourite facets of the paranormal, especially when it comes to ghosts, is hitchhiking ghosts, Ruth. Now, for me, I have to say, I tend to think a lot of them are urban myth. But there is one particular story here in the UK, and I'm sure you've come across this one, which was the incredible experience of a gentleman called Ray Fulton, who was the carpet fitter. Now, most of these, it's always, you know, we usually have these archetypal stories where someone picks up a bedraggled young person and they get told an address and they go there and the person disappears on the way and they go to the house and they go, oh, yes, that's...
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
My daughter or my son that was killed hitchhiking home from university 10 years ago and da-da-da-da-da. However, his story is remarkable because he's very matter-of-fact. I think in every time I've ever seen him interviewed, he never changed his story. And it was the fact that he was so convinced he'd picked somebody up, he offered him a cigarette.
Yes.
And it was at that point that it vanished.
Makes no embellishment about some tale behind why the person was there or anything.
No.
He just tells it as it is. He stopped to pick somebody up. They got in his van. He drove a mile or two, thought it was odd the bloke was being quiet, went to offer him a cigarette, and the bloke disappeared. And he hadn't opened the van door and jumped out because the van, you know, hadn't slowed down, and anyway, the interior light would have come on.
Yes.
And so, I mean... Curiously, that story is actually not very far from where I live.
Yes, yeah, because I think it was near Leighton Buzzard.
Yeah, it's only 10, 12 miles, something like that.
Mm.
So I've actually driven along what's left of that bit of road, as far as you can tell from what he says.
Yeah.
Because it's actually, since then, it's been bisected by a new bypass and much of that old road is gone.
Mm.
So, you know, there's only bits of it where you can think, well, he must have been driving along this bit from what you can piece together of his interviews. So I've been along there and, you know, I've reached out and asked people around there whether they've ever seen anything. And I haven't found anybody else that's experienced anything there so far. But like you, I do find that original account quite fascinating.
It is. It's definitely a story of its time as well, Ruth, because I remember the first time I saw him, I think he was on Arthur C. Clarke. The first time I ever saw it as a very young person. And I love the fact that when it happened, he was so scared, he sped off to the nearest pub and he went and had a double whiskey.
Because
that's what you need to do when you've had a shock and you're driving, is have some alcohol. I mean, that is not, you know, that is a story that could only have happened in the 1970s, I think.
Absolutely.
So is that something that you've, because I think they're one of those things, because I spoke to a gentleman last year, Dr. Rob Gandhi, who collects road ghost stories. It's his thing. He loves these stories of these disembodied spirits hanging around the roadways and byways of Britain. Is that something you think has become more prevalent in the modern era, Ruth, in your experience and the stories you've stumbled across? Because obviously a hitchhiking ghost can only sort it. It's quite a modern phenomenon, I would suggest.
It is. I do know of some older that you could almost call hitchhiking, except they're... You see, if you think about it, the old Headless Highwayman ghost is kind of that era's equivalent. Every road had its haunted highwayman type tale, or its coach and horses type tale. These days, you get the person stumbling along the road, or the hitchhiker type tale.
Mm.
In one particular case, you get the disappearing car.
Yes.
And then they found out when they actually went, or the police were called that night. And when they went and searched, they found the car down the embankment with the dead person in it that had been there for a year.
Yes.
Can't for the life of me remember quite where that was. Somewhere in Surrey.
Yes, that's a very frightening case.
It really is. And it's completely true.
Mm.
You know, it is absolutely true that on that particular night, a number of motorists phoned frantically into the police saying they'd just seen a car careen off this fast bit of dual carriageway and down an embankment. So, of course, the police rushed out to the scene and tried to find it, and they couldn't find any sign of crash or, you know, vegetation being knocked down or anything. So they just kind of widened their search because they'd had so many calls.
Mm.
They thought there must be something. And they actually, deep in the undergrowth, down the embankment by the side of the dual carriageway, they found a car and a skeleton. And it turned out to be this chap that had been reported missing a year earlier.
Mm.
And the search for him had never looked in that area because he wasn't expected to be in that area. He was from London.
Yeah.
So, you know, when he was reported as missing, he was missing in London, not in Surrey. So at some point on the night that he went missing, he must have driven out of London. Nobody knows why. Had some sort of crash again. Nobody knows why.
Mm.
The car had gone down this embankment and there it had lain undetected for all this time because it was in such thick undergrowth.
Mm.
And they were actually able to say that he didn't die instantly because the skeleton was a little way away from the car where he'd obviously crawled out of the car.
Mm.
And yet, you know, died alone. And then somehow, sometime later, that scene replayed itself enough for several motorists to see the car.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think, honestly, when I was writing Roadmap of British Ghosts, all the people I spoke to and all the different accounts and the dozens and dozens and dozens of accounts there are in that one, I have literally, and I'm not exaggerating, I have become quite nervous about driving on my own at night. And it used to be.
Yes.
Especially because near here, just about 2-3 miles up the road, we've got a very, very active full apparition haunting on one of the lanes.
Mm.
And I've now got several accounts of it. And I saw the damn thing last year.
Mm.
And that's going to be in the next book. And I have not, I am ashamed as a ghost investigator to say this, I have not yet plucked up the courage to go down that road on my own after dark again since. The only time I will now drive down it is if I've got somebody with me in the car, because it was just so creepy.
Yeah. They are peculiar as well, because I there are a couple of stories, and I think there's one of them in the Roadmap, where which is a remarkable case, because I think four people are in a car and only two of them see the actual apparition and scream. And the other two are like, what on earth are you screaming at?
What are you screaming about?
Because they haven't seen anything, which I think is a remarkable response, because it's either all or nothing often, Rube.
It often is, but that comes back to the whole Robin theory, doesn't
yes.
it? You know, just because you're all present doesn't mean you'll necessarily all see it.
Mm.
You know, it's so easy to have your attention taken for a moment. Even if you're watching television or something, and how many times do one of you in the room say, what just happened? Rewind that bit.
Mm.
And yet you were all looking at the screen. So to me, it's that kind of, it's the same theory, that that's something to do with how the human mind can easily be distracted. And two people in the car just weren't paying enough attention at that moment. Oh, and two suddenly scream and you're like, what the heck?
I think that's very interesting, because I think if you ask a lot of people who drive perhaps the same route to work, Ruth, and I think if you ask them when they get to wherever they're going, if you ask them to tell them about what they've done, a lot of people can't actually say what they've seen, or it's basically, it's so ingrained in them that they just seem to do it on autopilot.
Yeah, it becomes complete autopilot.
Mm.
And actually, I had a really interesting instance of that. When I was working as an investigator, my job took me all over the country when I was still full time.
Mm.
So I was often literally driving from one end of the UK to the other, and I might be going to 5 different cities in 1 week, you know, so hundreds and hundreds of miles. And there was one particular day I was driving along in our Land Rover Discovery on my way to do an investigation interview. I was driving along listening to the radio and I suddenly thought, I can't remember where I'm going. Where am I supposed to be going today? And then I realised I couldn't remember where I was. I couldn't remember which motorway I was on.
Mm.
I couldn't remember which direction I was heading in. I couldn't remember where I was supposed to be going. And I drove along for about 10 miles, getting more and more frantic, thinking, heck, am I on the right road? Am I heading in the right direction? Where am I going? And I had to wait until I saw a road sign to say, right, you're on the M1 heading north.
Mm.
Okay, am I supposed to be on the M1 heading north?
Yes.
And I actually had to pull in to the next services and get open my diary.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember I'm going now. I'm on my way to Liverpool. That's fine. And I was going to go across the A50. That's fine, yeah. It's fine. I'm in the right place. But just for a moment, my brain had gone, you've done so much driving lately, I can't be bothered to remember which bit you're doing now.
Yes.
Or where you're going, or whether you're supposed to be going that way, you know. And it's so easy for the human brain to distract itself and allow something to just bypass the senses and go straight into the subconscious.
Absolutely.
That it makes it very hard when you're trying to deal with something like the paranormal, that by its very nature is going to be more fleeting and more insubstantial, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one of those things as well, because obviously in collaboration with your growing reputation and your work, Ruth, have you found that as your books are becoming more popular and you're becoming more well known? Because obviously, as I said earlier, prior to being recommended your books through Amazon, which is primarily that, and then as if by magic you appeared on another show within a week or so. I had been looking recently at the show's Facebook page, and I've actually got a couple of articles with you in it from last summer where you'd appeared in local press looking for stories, which always makes me chuckle when weird little things like that happen.
City, you see.
Absolutely. So have you discovered that as your work has become more well known and these stories have started to develop, Ruth, you're finding more and more stories coming to you? Don't need to go investigating as much. They tend to, more stories are coming to you these days.
To a certain extent, yes, that is happening. It's 4 years that I've been publishing the books, and you know, you're quite right, the books are now selling quite well. You know, I've got quite a good following. And I do quite a lot of interviews and radio interviews and podcasts and so on. I am more well known than obviously when I started. And certainly I get a certain number of stories now where people will write to me and email me and say, you know, I've just heard you on such and such a radio station, or I've just read about you in such and such a newspaper, or I've just listened to such and such a podcast with you in it, and I wanted to tell you about my story. The most recent of that was only I think it was the 20th of September. And you know, it happened to the young chaps involved that night, and they happened to hear one of my radio interviews that night. And they're not into the paranormal, it's just that it decided to be into them that night. And then they happened to hear me on a late night radio station, you know, being interviewed about paranormal. So they reached out to try and find out whether anybody else had experienced anything along that stretch of road. Unfortunately, it's not on my database, so I haven't got anybody else along there. But that's another story now that will go into These Haunted Times Volume 2, or possibly Roadmap Volume 2, depending on which way I split it, because they reached out to me. So I do get a number now that, having, you know, podcasts or interviews or radio interviews or whatever, then reach out and give me their stories, which is absolutely fantastic, because it just sets me off on another whole round of, oh, there's another location to add to the database and start trying to track down, you know. My poor database, it is creaking at the edges. I've had to split it into three now. Because otherwise it's just so big, even I can't find my way around it. It's sort of general ghosts, road ghosts, and anniversary ghosts are the three databases now. But even that, they're just ridiculously huge.
So what kind of recent reports are you getting? Because obviously you're building up to, like you say, you might be releasing two books, but you've definitely got one coming, whichever one comes out first, Ruth. So have you had any, you know, a couple of recent encounters you could share with us at all?
Well, I think that most interesting one is that one. It was from Brooke in Wiltshire. And it was a group of lads, young lads. From the way he was chatting, I was picturing them in their early 20s, although I didn't outright ask them. And they'd been out for the evening, and they'd bought a takeaway, and they'd gone back to one of the lads' houses and eaten the takeaway till quite late at night. And then one of the lads had given one of the other lads a lift home. I'd given him a lift home and then returned to the house where they were all gathered at, because he was the only one that was sober and was able to drive. And this lad he had to give a lift home to needed to get home for work the next morning, because this was a Sunday night. On the way home from dropping the friend off back to the house where all the other lads were, he was driving down, I think it's called Brokerwood Road, just near Brook in Wiltshire, when all of a sudden, and literally with no warning, right in front of his car was a lady wearing what he thought was a nightdress, so a long white gown of some description, who appeared to have blood on her face. And he literally didn't have any time to slow the car. He hit the brakes, but she was so close in front of the car when he saw her, the car just passed straight through her. And he pulled the car to a stop on the side of the road, looking into rearview mirror, there was nothing there. nothing in the road at all. But the weirdest thing was that he was so shaken by it. I mean, shaken by it, obviously, because he'd just A, seen an apparition, B, just driven through it, C, hadn't able to stop. But it was actually his mate that contacted me rather than he himself, because he was too shaken to want to talk to me, because it literally only happened 2 or 3 days before. And the thing that he was trying to articulate to his friend to tell me was, it wasn't just the shock of seeing the ghost or whatever she was, or the shock of not being able to stop the car, or the shock of it passing through her. It was the fact that when he pulled to the side of the road, for a few minutes, he could not orient himself as to where he was or what was happening. And he had this completely inexplicable feeling of sadness go through him. And he just sat there sobbing at the side of the road. And he couldn't make any sense of, why am I feeling sad? Shocked, yes, sure. Frightened, sure. But he was overwhelmingly sad, almost as if he'd taken on, you know, as she passed through the car, he'd taken on whatever was in her mind. He then made it back to his mates. Of course, they were all very shaken up about it. They happened to then hear my interview on the radio, and one of them wanted to, you know, sort of contact me a couple of days later. The lad that it happened to had then driven back to the location the following day on the Monday to try and see whether he could account for it in some way. Was there some kind of optical illusion or whatever that had fooled him, you know? But he couldn't see anything that could account for it, apart from the fact he noticed a bit of cloth in the road that he thought looked like it had blood stains on it. So, of course, the first thing I said to the lad who was talking to me was, well, can one of you go back and get the cloth?
Yes. Yes.
And they actually did for me. They actually did drive back to look, and it had gone, unfortunately. You know, they were able to sort of message me back about half an hour later, so no, we've just been, it's not there anymore. So we will never now know whether there would have been some evidence that we could actually pick up and examine. But yeah, so that, you know, that was literally... It could not get any hotter off the press than that account, because it had literally only happened a couple of nights before.
Blimey. I mean, that is incredible as well, because it's always interesting when you come across such a response like that. But to have such a deeply emotional response to the event, as you say, yes, obviously it could be shocked and a little bit shaken up. And I think anybody that's had the misfortune of having a car accident or being involved in even a prang, it's surprising how you can be shaken up by it, Ruth. But to have that much of an emotional response where really nothing's happened, essentially, he's... You know, nobody's been hurt. The car hasn't been damaged. He's simply had an experience that has completely bewildered him, that it's caused him to have such an emotional breakdown in response to it.
Yeah. And he was trying to explain to his friend that he couldn't explain where those feelings were coming from. Almost as if they weren't his feelings. Yeah. He was feeling shocked, of course.
Yeah.
But this overwhelming sadness... He'd got no reason to be feeling that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very bizarre one. I should be trying to find out if anybody else has had an experience along there. You never know.
Yes, well, stranger things have happened. I mean, is it often as well, Ruth, have you been surprised sometimes when you've appeared on local radio or a particular show or an interview? Have you ever been surprised at a certain area where perhaps you didn't expect there to be as big a response as you may have considered?
Do you know, I get that quite a lot, actually. I did one just recently. It started off in response to a newspaper article down in Wiltshire, which, interestingly, was how that radio interview came about, because they read the newspaper article. But I'd had a post out about a particular location in Wiltshire. Somebody had responded and said, oh, we've just seen an article about you. I don't know about that ghost that you're asking about, but I've had this experience in Blandford Forum, which is a small town in Wiltshire, as many people know.
Yes.
So, of course, I went out looking for correlations of that. And what I found was loads and loads of people got back in touch who all along clustered around the high street area in all different properties, but all clustered in the same area. They were all having paranormal experiences along the couple of streets that sort of radiate out from the town centre. And almost all of them were happening in the upstairs floors of the buildings, which is just bizarre. And several of them were a definitely female presence. So whether they're linked or not, who knows? Just fascinating to think, well, that's an incredibly active town centre.
Yes, very much. Are they terraced houses, Ruth? Is it something where
special properties? It's all the shops and what have you along the streets radiating out from the market square. And it's in the upstairs rooms, you know, that are the sort of offices or the storage or whatever, depending on what the shop below is. Mm. Or in one case, it's a pub, and these are the upstairs rooms, bedrooms, you know, that is a hotel come pub. Mm. So I can't quite remember off the top of my head how, but I ended up with like five or six different properties, all within a few hundred yards of each other, with paranormal activity in them, current paranormal activity or recent within the last decade, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it astonishes me how often I find pockets like that where you go out with one and you get lots of people writing back and saying, well, not that property, but the one two doors down, you know, well, not that street, but the street that backs onto it. Mm. And it does make you wonder whether certain areas are more susceptible to paranormal activity than others. Who knows?
Yeah. I've often found it really interesting as well, because obviously the UK itself, we've towns and cities up and down the length and breadth of the country, Ruth, where, you know, we've hundreds and hundreds of years of history, and it's often peculiar where certain areas seem to be, not necessarily tend to embrace it more, but there seems to be certain cities and towns in the UK where a history of haunting or specific ghosts seem to be more well established than certain other areas, despite the fact that perhaps these areas may not be particularly older than other places. I mean, York is a prime example, primarily because that's probably one of the best examples I can think of a really old ghost, because of the Centurion situation there. Whereas where I live here in Sheffield doesn't have a particularly well-known paranormal history, unless you live in the area and you look for it. It's not, you know, other than Stocks Bridge, most people would probably not suspect Sheffield to be a particularly haunted area, unless you know the area or you're from the city itself, Ruth. Have you ever come across somewhere where you were surprised how haunted an area was?
Constantly. I couldn't even just pick out one that I would say that about, honestly. I remember, just to give an example, there's a small little village called Whitwell in Hertfordshire, and it really is a small little village. And when I went out on social media asking, there was a particular ghost story I was chasing up on, which was quite an old story, probably 100 years old or more, of the sound of a woodman, you know, chopping his axe in the woods along this particular stretch of road. It was when I was researching for Roadmap.
Yeah.
And I had that many people come back with local stories. I think I ended up with something like 9 or 12 different ghosts hanging around Whitwell.
Oh.
And this village is tiny, really tiny.
Yeah.
I actually wrote back to them on social media and said, I'm surprised any of you dare leave your houses at night. You must be having to push your way through the throngs of ghosts.
Oh, goodness. So what's going on there then, Ruth?
Well, I'd have to go, you know, I end up with so many stories. I have trouble remembering them without going back to my own books to look for them. But I do remember one of them was a lady frying fish, because that always stuck in my head.
Wow.
There's a ghost of a lady sitting at the side of the road frying fish in a pan. I mean, just absolutely bizarre. But that one did stick in my head. But another one was Great Wakering in Essex. That was another one that came back with just so many stories of paranormal occurrences.
Mm.
And again, you know, the one I was chasing down was quite a small little story.
Mm.
And I just came back with so many properties on the high street were haunted. So, yeah, I mean, whether once a paranormal hotspot occurs, it kind of feeds on itself or something. I don't know. I really don't know.
And that is unusual, because I think famously now, I'm trying to remember, is it Plumley that you used to claim to be the most haunted village in Britain? Is it Plumley?
No.
Where they got, it's a fairly small village, but they claim to have about 13 ghosts or something that live
in. Yes. I know the one you mean. It does begin PLU.
Pluckley.
That's it.
Pluckley, not Plumley.
Something's on the tip of your tongue.
Yeah. Apologies to anybody who lives in a village called Plumley. I didn't mean to scare anybody.
No, we're not leaving now.
But yeah, Pluckley is one of those examples, because I've actually been to Pluckley, and that's one of those places that it isn't particularly large. I think it's a mile from end to end, if that. And that used to claim to have at least 13 very different ghosts as well, Ruth.
Yes.
They're not all the same, because sometimes you might think, oh, well, it's always a green lady or a white lady or a monk or something like that. And they've got, I think one of the strangest ones they got there was a jockey. Because I think there's a racecourse training centre near there, and people would often see a jockey in his colours crossing the road and walking straight through a wall.
Astonishing, isn't it? How some areas just. I know I've got one from Pluckley somewhere, where somebody wrote to me they'd heard the sound of a horse galloping down the road in the middle of the night. That was in Pluckley, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So yes, you know, I sometimes wonder whether it's that certain places have more activity, or is it just that certain places have more people willing to engage and talk about the activity? Because I know that I really struggle with certain areas of the country to find any social media being used as a sort of chat type forum.
Yes.
To be able to go out and ask the question. So certain pockets around the country just don't seem to engage with each other in that way. So whether that's when that happens, where you get pockets of, I don't know, a not very neighbourly feeling or something, that then you don't get the generation of stories happening. I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know. It'd be somebody, you know, some urban psychologist or whatever to work out the logistics of that. But
yeah,
but there are definitely places that you think, good grief, you know, that this... It really is active around here, and not just old stories, but people still having experiences, you know.
Absolutely. I think one of the things I'm often sad about is in regards to Yorkshire was renowned as being a centre of the coal industry, Ruth. And I've got a couple of marvellous books that were released in the 1990s that are all about ghosts that miners had encountered in the pit. And I often wonder, here we are sort of 20, 25 years later, you know, every pit in the UK is essentially closed these days.
Yeah.
Be it for coal or tin as well, because obviously there's a lot of stories in, especially Cornwall, in regards to the strange encounters that people had in tin. And I often wonder how many of these stories we were in danger of forgetting about or losing sight of, because that industry is essentially... ended. It often makes me wonder, could we look at things like shipbuilding? Because obviously there used to be some wonderful old stories about, you know, the ghosts of in shipbuilding and things like that as well, Ruth. Is that something you've kind of come across, or do you think that we really need to kind of keep an eye on what has been reported in case we lose these stories?
It's one of the things that in collecting the data that I do feels important to me, to collect the data and get it recorded. So, you know, with writing the books, I wanted to have it put down for posterity. Right, here are the accounts for this village, this road, this building, this whatever, that were current up to the point I published this book, so that you've got it down in record. Because you're quite right, you know, if you talk about something like ghosts down the mines, for example, just because the people aren't going down the mines anymore because they're shut, are the ghosts still down there?
Yes.
And that's a fascinating thought in its own right, isn't it? Or, you know, like with the shipbuilding industry, you know, as people move out of those industries, and increasingly in the modern world, that kind of industry becomes smaller and smaller, doesn't it? Are you going to get fewer and fewer accounts? I mean, I've got a wonderful account for These Haunted Times 2, Volume 2, from Wilver Power Station in Anglesey. First-hand account, spoken to the person myself. It's been reported before in other books, but I've interviewed the chap myself, and he was very keen to have his story correctly reported this time rather than embellished. But, of course, you know, Wilver Power Station is shut now. Is that ghost still wandering around those grounds? Who knows? And will she be lost because there's nobody there to see her and nobody there to record it now? I don't know, it's a bit of a sad thought when you think of it like that.
Well, it is as well, isn't it? I think often we forget about the modernisation of the world, and obviously city centres often bear very little resemblance depending on where you live. You know, there are certain cities that seem to have embraced their heritage in regards to Chester is a prime example, York's another one. But obviously there are some places like Sheffield. Essentially, most of Sheffield is fairly modern, because obviously we got bombed to high heaven during the Second World War, Ruth. Absolutely, because of the steelworks. And essentially, there are a couple of notable hauntings that have come from the Second World War, especially terrible story about we used to have a bar in Sheffield called the Marples, where they were having a dance one particular evening, and they took a direct hit from a bomb, and essentially they just filled it in because there wasn't much left to get out, sadly. And there was, I think there was over 100 people in there when that was hit. And that itself has led on, that area has been built on top of, which is the other thing as well, you think about these buildings being built on top of mass graves. And that has often led to numerous reports of people hearing music and dancing and chatting like they're at a bar. But it's been numerous. It's been a motorcycle equipment shop. It's been a betting shop. It's been a pawnbroker's. It was a bar for quite a while. And in my younger days, I was a landlord. So I used to go in there, and the staff would often tell that it was one of those wonderful pubs where the ghosts seemed to not like leaving the taps on, so they would often turn the beer off in the cellar. And that tended to be the one. But nothing seems to have been reported since it's not been a bar. There's been a couple of little stories, and I think that's a shame, because that was one of the most well-established hauntings in my local area that these days doesn't seem to be reported at all.
And you wonder if that's because the... because it's no longer a bar, whether that was actually a Stone Tape Theory recording type haunting, mostly, although obviously it'd have to be a bit more if it was turning taps off. But, you know, so now because the conditions are no longer right, it's not provoking the paranormal to occur. So now, who knows?
Who knows?
Why I just stay fascinated forever about it.
Fantastic. Well, listen, before I let you go, because it's been wonderful to speak to you at last, is there anything that you've recently kind of given you a shiver, a recent encounter or story you've come across, Ruth, that's given you pause for thought and maybe given you goosebumps?
Well, it's definitely the one that I saw myself last Christmas.
Right.
Without a doubt, there's a particular road not far from where I live where over probably the last decade, I think I've now found 4 or 5 other people who've seen this figure of a man, heavy set chap, wearing what you'd think of as an old style donkey jacket, maybe. A heavy work coat that comes past the hip level. Thick, heavy work trousers and thick, heavy work style boots. Just standing in the road at ridiculous hours of the morning, where there wouldn't possibly be anybody there normally. And I'd found several people that'd seen him, and it so happens that that road is one that I drive along every fortnight on a Wednesday evening for a particular thing I go to. And so, having found the story, obviously, you can imagine, ghost investigator, I'm on high alert every time I come down that road last year looking for the ghost along the stretch of road that he's said to be seen on. And this particular night was just, it must have been about early December last year. It was Wednesday night. It would have been about 20 past 10 at night. It was one of those nights where it was a strong moonlight, but there was both a mist rising and a fog starting to fall. So you had that weird kind of, one bit of road would be completely clear. The next bit would have patches of low mist. And then you'd drive into a bit where there was fog falling, so you'd have fog hanging above the road. And you were driving under it. And there was a frost. So you'd got glittering frost, grey fog, silver mist, patches of bright sunlight, moonlight as you drive along. So everything is in shades of grey and black and glittery frost colour and silver moonlight colour. And I carefully looked for him along the stretch of road that he's supposed to be. He wasn't there. So I drove on, started thinking about other stuff like you do. A couple of miles further down the same lane, I'm passing the entranceway to a farm that some friends of ours had recently inherited, and they'd been having some trouble with squatters trying to get onto the property. So I've turned to look at the farm to make sure there's no lights or vehicles where there shouldn't be. Turned back to look at the road ahead, where I have my main beams on and the road ahead is more or less straight, so I can see quite as far ahead as your lights reach on main beam. And there's nobody in the road ahead, and I'm doing about 50 miles an hour, and I get another couple of hundred yards from the entrance of the farm up the road, and all of a sudden, on the side of the road, right next to the driver's side of my car, because it's quite a narrow country lane, is the figure of a man facing away from me, heavy set, wearing a donkey jacket type jacket, below the hip. these heavy trousers boots. It's clearly the same figure, except he was facing away from me. And instead of being in normal colours, if you like, he looked like he was in an all-over patchwork of the colours of the night, i.e. the silver of the moon, the sparkle of the frost, the grey of the mist and the dark grey of the fog. So it's almost like he was made up of all those colours at once all over him.
Yeah.
And he appeared, when you bear in mind, I'm probably doing about maybe 40 miles an hour, maybe 50 miles an hour at this point.
Yeah.
He appeared just in front of the bonnet of the car on my driver's side, on the side of the road, not in front of the car.
Mm-hmm.
So as the car passes him, you're literally talking a split second. And I whip my head round to watch him as I go past him, thinking, where the hell did he come from?
Yeah.
He goes out of view as he goes behind the car, obviously. I look at my rearview mirror, can't see him. Carry on forward, arguing with myself. Turn around, go back and look for him.
Yeah.
You are a goddamn ghost investigator. You are never afraid of ghosts. You always go rushing in to double check something you've just heard or seen or whatever. I do a lot of ghost hunting and I always go and double check when something happens.
Yeah.
And nothing I could do to persuade myself to turn that car around and go back and look for him, because there was just this horrible feeling about him that I can't describe, and it just didn't feel safe to turn around and go and look for him. And I could not bring myself to turn that car around, despite the fact that I was literally berating myself because I'm a damn ghost investigator. Get back there and investigate it. And I went on round the next curve, you start to enter the next village,
yeah,
where there happens to be a rugby club, which was just, you know, people can drink in there.
Yeah.
And that was obviously just at turning out time. And there was a chap walking along the road, obviously leaving that walking home, and my headlights picked him out at the normal distance. And I, you know, I could see how his clothing was clearly showing as normal muted coloured clothing, that the way headlights make the colours go muted.
Yes.
So it wasn't anything about that night the headlights were refracting differently or something. There was something odd about the colouring of the one I just, you know, the apparition I just passed. And I've driven that road so many times since, and I've driven it with other people in the car, and we've tried it with the headlights on main beam and dip beam. There is no way you could have not seen him the full distance of your main beam ahead of you if that had been a genuine person standing beside the road.
Yeah.
There was nowhere that a genuine person could have stepped out of. There's no hedgerow thick enough, there's no fence, that, you know, it's an open bit of road. So how did he come to appear literally in front of my car and not be seen the full length of my headlights ahead? Don't know. Wow. Don't want to see it again.
Well, I mean, and that alone shows your diligence there, Ruth, because you've gone down there several times. You've tried to explain it. You've tried it, different lighting, you know, high beam, low beam, obviously with other people, clearly trying to recreate it. I suspect probably to put your mind at rest more than anything.
I just wish I'd had the guts to turn around. It's so unlike me, honestly. If you saw me doing an investigation usually and something goes bang, or you hear a voice on the EVP or whatever it might be, I'm straight back in that room trying to see it again.
Yes.
On my own, in the dark, don't mind, not scared. But there was something about that. I could not turn that car around. It just, there was something very, very wrong feeling about the figure somehow. So, yeah, there you go.
Fabulous. Well, thank you for scaring us there.
Night on your own if you dare.
Oh, well, I don't think we can better that today. So listen, Ruth, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure. Like I say, I've been wanting to speak to you for quite a while. I wish you all the very best with your burgeoning career. It's delightful to find an author who's as down to earth and as pragmatic as yourself in regards to the way you investigate and collect these stories. So where can everybody keep up to date and find your work, and if they've got a story to share, how can they get hold of you?
The simplest way is by email. So my email address for anybody wanting to write to me is wa-1400@outlook.com. And you can connect with me by Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, just by typing in Ruth Roper Wilde, with the Wild spelt the way I do, which is W-Y-L-D-E. So you can connect me with through any of those media. And you can find the books on Amazon, so just and actually quite a few other bookstores now. So if you just type in Ruth Roper Wilde into Google, it'll bring it up for you as to where you want to choose to buy the books from. But Amazon is probably your cheapest.
Yes, fabulous. And I'll make sure I put links to everything in the show notes for anybody that wants to pick it up later on, and your email address as well, Ruth, if they need to send you any more scary encounters or give you some more food for thought. So thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure. I look forward to your next release, and hopefully we will get a chance to speak to you again sometime.
Hope so, Paul. It's been really fun.
My pleasure. You take care.
You too.